This is KWMR Point Reyes Station. My name is Benny, and I listen to KWMR on 92.3 in San Geronimo Valley.
Media support for KWMR is provided by the Point Reyes Light, family-owned since 1948. Information on classified subscriptions, advertising, and more at ptreyeslight.com or at 415-669-1200.
Episode on KWMR. There are thousands of men and women across the state who are fighting wildland blazes in the hopes of protecting property and natural resources for all of us Californians. Often they are members of the state firefighting agency, CAL FIRE. What's not always known is what are the details of their lives and jobs and some of the emotional lives that they live being firefighters in the state. Well, today on Epicenter, we're fortunate in that we have a firsthand account. We have Joe Fizacarly, and yes, that is a relation, who's here to talk about life as a California wildland firefighter. And besides being in the studio, I just would mention that he's joining us today. We'll talk about a number of issues. He does work for CAL FIRE, but he's not a representative of CAL FIRE. He's not trying to explain the policies or defend any of the criticisms or take any of the credit for the large amount of success that agency has had. So anyway, he's mostly here because he's a first-person storyteller and also we're related. For my own part, there goes the journalistic objectivity when your family member gets on the radio with you. So my objective lenses are over here somewhere on the table, but they're going to be off for this half hour. So here we are again, part two of a two-part episode on wildland firefighting, what it's really like. And Joe, I just want to welcome you back to KWMR.
Good to be here.
Yeah. And, last episode we were talking about some of the day-to-day things that you do as part of fighting fires. I'd like to circle back for a little bit, and maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the life of the wildland firefighter. So, take us into the early hours of when you arrive to work, and where do you work, and what happens from there when the place is not going up in flame?
Station life is great. It kind of starts to make you go crazy after too long, but it's a good time. You show up at work and everyone's got duties, everyone's got chores. I'm in the Pacheco station, which is down in like Hollister, Gilroy area.
Right. So if you went down 101, you would just take a left at like 152 or something.
Correct.
Like that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's on a Pacheco Pass highway.
Right.
Yeah, you got to make sure the station is clean at all times, so there's pretty much endless cleaning going on. We run PTs in the morning,
PTs
physical
are,
training,
okay,
and that is anywhere from circuit workouts to a hike. We're fortunate enough to, right behind our station, we've got 2,000-foot elevation gain hill that we can hike, and it puts us in good shape, because that is pretty much the majority of our travel is hiking. I'm a professional hiker.
Okay. So, but it's not just a day pack and some binoculars. What are you hauling up that hill?
Our pack is, depending on what's in it and how much water you've drank, it's anywhere from 40 to 60 pounds.
Okay.
And
can you break that down for us?
What's in it?
Yeah, what's in it?
Okay, we've got a fire shelter, which is those last ditch, you might have seen them in movies, little tinfoil things that, they're supposed to.
They work pretty well?
Yeah, supposedly they stop 95% of radiant heat, but they don't stop any actual flame impingement, so that's, you know, take that what you will. If you're using it, you're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, well, you got 2 gallons of water, and it depends on the complement of tools that you have, depends on what your job is. So because I'm a sawyer, yeah.
Oh, it's just, hang on with the water there. 2 gallons sounds like a lot of water.
Yeah.
Why would you need that much water?
Because you go through a lot of water. They say that you're supposed to go through, you know, a quart every hour of arduous labor.
Mm-hmm.
But I go through more. It's very arduous labor. It's actually a really serious issue. We had a guy recently who got rhabdo. So that's...
Okay, so rhabdo is a
rhabdomyolysis.
Kind of, yeah, a breve.
Yeah. It's really, really dangerous, and it's life-threatening.
It's like a life-threatening condition which involves kind of a muscular breakdown with a lot of release of toxins into the bloodstream.
And, yeah. It can result in kidney failure or
put your kidneys at risk, yeah.
Yeah. So that's really dangerous. That results from dehydration or lack of sodium. So that's, you know, a big priority for what we're carrying because we don't know how far we are away from a water supply or how soon we'll have water next. And so like I was saying, the complement of tools depends on where you are in the hook line. And because I'm a sawyer,
Hook line?
Hook sawyer. Line? Okay, hook line.
Hook line I just have to stop you because, you know, it is Greek to some of us.
Okay, you need an index to check out. So the hook line is the order in which the crew is assembled. So if you ever see a crew walking around, they're always walking in a straight line. And that is in order of their tool. So there's saws, cuts, and scrapes. And those are different tools for each for accomplishing a different set of objectives. And I'm a saw, so I'm at the front. And, you know, I've got everywhere from a whole saw kit and extra chain, a bunch of tools that I need for working on the saw or troubleshoot it if something goes wrong. And then you've got, you know, headlamps. You need all of your food for the day. We get what's called line lunches on these campaign fires.
They sound delicious. What are they made up of?
It's 8,000 calories. That's it. And so it's...
I think I've seen that. Yeah. I think it has Coast Guard on the wrapper.
It's a bag of just whatever they can think of to get to 8,000 calories. It's like a gnarly, soggy sandwich and candy bars. And they've gotten better recently, actually. I won't talk too bad about them because they have gotten a little better. But like Clif bars and anything you can think of to try to just get you calories. Anyway, you stuff your pack with that. And what else? You got all sorts of different tools.
You got some first aid equipment.
You got a stop the bleed kit.
Which
you
includes,
got extra clothes.
Which includes
too.
A tourniquet, yeah.
Yeah, it's tourniquet, gauze, the quick clot.
Why would someone with a chainsaw need a tourniquet? I don't get it.
No, we have chaps, so we don't need that.
Okay. Hey, it's Epicenter on KWMR. I'm Jim Fazakerly. I'm in hosting today. My guest in the studio is Joe Fazakerly. Yes, right. That's a common last name around here. Anyway, my son Joe is with me, and we're talking about the lived experience of a wildland firefighter and what it takes. What toll does it ask the firefighter to pay in doing this pretty remarkable job and career? So, Joe, we're talking about all the stuff that make up the 60 pounds that you haul up these hills to do your work. What are the other physical demands of the job, would you say?
Well,
one is heat for sure, right?
Yeah.
Can you say something
heat
more
is my,
about that?
Heat is my mortal enemy. I am constantly trying to not be as hot as I am. You're wearing, you know, for me on the saw, I've got pants with chaps on the outside of that. And then we have a cotton shirt with yellows on the top. And then a helmet and gloves. And if you're working around fire, you want to have your sleeves down and cuffed, and you have these gloves that have gauntlets on them that, you know, help to prevent fire from getting in there. And it all just makes you hotter. And so when it's 100 degrees out, it almost there are some times when I think it's just like what am I supposed to do here? I'm gonna die. it's so hot, and the task that we are given is work next to fire, which is hot, and work uphill, because the hand crew's responsibility is, in terms of cutting line, it is we go where the dozers can't go. So that's always going to be something perilous and horrible and steep and rocky. And so you're with the pack on and the chainsaw, which is about 25 pounds when it's full of fuel and oil, you're just, it's difficult. It's very difficult. But yeah, you make it work. You drink as much water as you can. You're popping salt pills every 10 minutes. And yeah, it's... that's kind of what you're looking at.
So that perseverance through adversity must be a pretty special feeling, because even as you sit there, you couldn't call this last description a complaint, because you're smiling, you kind of have a lighthearted vision of this hardship. Is it something that just at the end of the day, you just know, oh, I made it through that gauntlet, and there's something to be really proud of? Or...
The masochistic kind of addicting part to it is that you're pushing yourself to a place that you will never go in any other situation. Mm-hmm. There is that whole theory of, you know, when you think you've given it all, you still actually have 50% in the tank is 100% true. Mm-hmm. You get to a point where you just like, I got nothing left. And then you keep going. And then you keep going, and it's 5 hours have gone by, and you've been doing that level of work for 5 hours longer than you thought you could.
Can you say something about, I'm reminded about the military axiom about, you know, people don't fight and die for a cause or for a country. They do it for their buddy that's with them. I mean, can you say something about the role or the importance of your team and the people who are on your unit? I mean, how does that interplay with what you're doing and how hard you work?
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. We are a team, and everyone has their different role in the team between, you know, what level of leadership you're in. You got to do your job. It's interesting. It's kind of a cutthroat environment. It's a mix of, you know, we're encouraging each other and do your job. Like, do your job. You know, like, you, if you're not doing your job, then I have to do your job. And that's unacceptable. So it's this, we're here to lift each other up, and we do lift each other up. But at the end of the day, when there's a fire and we have an objective, you need to do your job. So and I love that. I love that environment of high expectations and high demand and, hard work.
Right. And so maybe that job is not for everybody. I mean, you have to have certain, I think you might have to have certain personality characteristics that make the fit right.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other things that make the fit right in that kind of super arduous job? You mentioned relationship skills, interrelation.
Yeah, you don't need to have that great of interrelationship skills. If you work hard, that's all I care about. Like, if it's nice, it's a nice environment to be in, because if you got a problem with someone, you just say, hey, what's your problem? What's the problem that you got? And then you handle it. That's it. There's no tiptoeing around or having grudges or anything like that. It's, you know, talk about it or go wrestle in the sand pit and figure it out.
So tell me a little bit about the hierarchy that you work within. So it's paramilitary. I know that. I know that there are division chiefs and battalion chiefs, and then you get down to the unit level, and you typically are led by a captain. Yeah. And so what kind of experience are you looking at when you have a captain of your unit? And then there are other people who are leaders within the unit. I know that you've spoken about a kind of battlefield promotion in the last big fire that you were on. Break that down a little bit for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's not super interesting. It's just the chain of command, which you have to go through when you have issues. It's always solve the problem at the lowest chain of command possible before bringing it up, and exhaust all resources before you ask questions. So you have the squaddy, who is the head of the crew, and that was the position that I was on for the Six Rivers fire that we were just at. And then above that, you have the captain, the crew captain. And then there's a bunch of different ways things are broken out, because you have, you know, you could have strike teams and all this stuff depending on what fire you're on. But then we've got there's a battalion chief who's above my captain, and then there's a unit chief, and then there's a division chief, and it just keeps going all the way up, especially because Cal Fire is so big that there's 20 different chiefs.
Right.
The line of chiefs goes forever. So,
but for your day-to-day reality, you're really just dealing with the captain.
Yeah. Okay. I deal with my crew captain.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the fire ground, there's a whole host of hazards. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those, especially some of the ones maybe people don't think about or haven't read about or seen on newsreels. What's going on when you get into a fire? And also, maybe if you could talk a little bit about how do you watch for those ahead of time so that they don't come up and bite you?
Yeah, so we have what's called 10 standing firefighter orders and the 18 watch-out situations that we have to memorize. The 10 orders are, you know, we never do something until we do, and we always do something until we don't. So, you know, we try our best with this. But the 10 orders are essentially written in blood. They're orders that come from some firefighter line-of-duty death and, you know, how they could have avoided that. And then the 18 watch-out situations are just situations that you'd want to say watch out. Like, one of them's taking a nap on the fire line. You want to have your heads up for that. Like, oh, you know, when you see that happening, that could be a danger. But we take these and go into the field. Safety is a really big priority. I love that about my captain. He definitely prioritizes safety, because it's like, you know, on these big fires, okay, another 10 acres burn, like, it's... we'll catch it. You know, it's the forests up there are hundreds and thousands of acres.
What is that?
But so that, sorry,
go ahead. Oh, what so, I was going to say. So give some examples of how your captain intervenes in safety issues.
He's just always heads up. He's always heads up, and he's always looking about, and the decisions he makes and the calls that he makes, they're always backed by, you know, I've assessed the threats and I've assessed the hazards, and given that, I'm willing to proceed. I've had captains in the past where it's like, all right, we're going to go fight the fire. And we're like, what's the plan? And they say, oh, we're going to come up with it, you know, on the fly. And it's like, no, that's not a good plan. I don't like that plan. I'd rather have more of a plan. But so, yeah, some of the main hazards that we're dealing with as a hand crew is, you know, besides the obvious fire, there's dehydration. You have to be able to, you know, be watching your crew to make sure that they're not starting to get some heat exhaustion or signs of dehydration, which is now really big for us because of my buddy got the rhabdo. And the biggest one and that causes the most injuries is falling trees and snags. And Widowmakers. So that's...
Widowmaker?
Widowmakers.
That's not the heart attack Widowmaker. It's a different...
No, it's okay. It's a dead branch that is, like, hanging off of a tree. And because it's kind of... it's spooky. I mean, I think there was someone in Oregon who... a hotshot who just had a tree fall on him, and he didn't make it, which is unfortunate. But that seems to be like what gets most people is these falling trees, because you'll go to sleep at night as a fire burns through the forest. It weakens everything that's still standing. So all the trees that are still standing, they're crisp and they are, you know, unstable. So when we go to sleep at night, it's spooky because you go to sleep and you think it's thunder, but it's just trees falling all night. There will just be trees just boom, boom. In the distance, and it's just like
there are a lot of war analogies in your job. I gotta tell you,
yeah. I think the trees are the biggest threat, but there's, you know, myriad mm-hmm. threats.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you personally have had a couple of close calls. So, you know, little things that you won't expect. You want to say anything about those?
Well, we didn't want Mom to see the video of the recently I was cutting down a tree and it like exploded because it was all rotted out and it got hung up and you know, lessons to be learned where, you know, I took the wrong escape route. I went directly backwards instead of at a 45 degree angle and I had some large debris fall on me and I was okay. It knocked my helmet off, but definitely things to learn from. We debrief it and we talk about, you know, what went wrong and get all the SAW teams together and say, okay, how do we avoid that ever happening?
Your PPE, you know, personal protective equipment, has come in really handy a couple of times.
Well, not the eye situation.
Tell the eye situation.
I was cutting a tree and I was wearing I'm so proud of these Radar EV glasses. They're mm-hmm. Oakleys and they make you look like a complete
Tom Cruise?
Kind of just like a dick. You know, you kind of look like my wife won't let me wear them in public because I look too racist, you know, those kinds of glasses.
Okay, yeah.
So I tell them they're work glasses, they're PPE. And anyway, I had put all my trust in these things. And I was so, you know, they've worked so well. But I was cutting this tree and I looked up to see if there was any Widowmakers above me. And a piece of wood got in my eye and it ended up being, I had two abrasions on my cornea and it was just the worst. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of, I've never had an eye injury like that. And it was just a, you know, 9 out of 10.
Which is no textbook will remind you about that possibility.
No.
Or even in a SOP, it's just one of those crazy, not so minor hazards that your job entails that's out there and not always recognizable. So you just have to be on your alert, I imagine, minute that you're out there.
Yeah, it's exhausting. I mean, you roll an ankle and you're out. And we're on hiking hills all the time.
Right,
so.
Right. Yeah, and that's a long hobble out if you roll your ankle and you're... How far into wild country or wilderness country will you get as a unit without, you know, immediate transportation available?
Like miles?
Yeah.
Yeah, we hike miles in. It's, again, it depends on whether we're doing these in-unit IA fires, initial attack fires, or we're doing these campaign fires. Mm-hmm. So the initial attack fires, it's usually like, oh, there's the fire, park here, hike there. These campaign fires, though, it's like we're sent to a drop point, and then from there we have to hike to our place we're trying to work,
which could be as far as,
you know, 5 miles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just for, you know,
yeah.
perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like I said, I'm a professional hiker. I'm a professional hiker. Yeah, I'm a professional wildland athlete
with an edge.
Yeah.
It's KWMR's Epicenter. I'm Jim Fazakerly. I'm hosting today, and my very special guest. Well, he's special because he's my son. It's Joe Fazakerly, and he has a career that has been launched with the state's firefighting agency, CAL FIRE. And as a wildland firefighter, he has a pretty unique set of experiences and perspectives to share with us in part two of a two-part series on the wildland firefighter and what I call back from the fireground. So, Joe, let's go into the interior landscape a little bit and talk about what it's like for you being gone from family and loved ones for up to what's it been? What's your longest stint been? About a month?
Yeah, a month. Usually, like, you can get a couple days off after a month, mm-hmm. But then you go back. And it sucks. It's not fun. It's puts serious strain on any relationship. My wife and I, we have, you know, both seasons so far, we've had probably a 2-week adjustment period where it's just we're trying to find the flow of me not being there. And, you know, there's a level of guilt that comes with that because it's like, you know, I want to be there.
Yeah.
And you're just not for very long periods of time. And, you know, you have to find a way that works for you, how to stay in communication to keep your relationship healthy.
Literally, how do you do that? How do you contact Francine and let her know, you know, what's coming up? How's it going?
We text for the most part. Uh-huh. We'll all get calls every now and then. Like, we'll call each other. But most of the time, calling is not really.
Cell service not so good out in the national forest.
Yeah. Yeah. Our new thing is, she said, okay, just every 24 hours, just text me safe. Like, I just need you to do that. And I was like, okay, I'll try to find, you know, just to send the word safe. And, yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's the unfortunate reality of this career is that, you know, there's pretty much everyone who's over a certain age has been divorced, and alcoholism is pretty rampant. And that's just, you know, the conditions kind of set those situations up. So luckily,
and that by the way is not a unique feature of Cal Fire. I think that's
all over.
That's a public safety epidemic.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, Cal Fire does a lot to mitigate that. They, the culture has definitely shifted from what it used to be, from, you know, what I hear in the fire service, and it's, you know, you're encouraged to nurture those relationships and to, you know, reach out if you need help. And what's great is that, like, everyone on your crew is going through the same thing. So there's no, like, shame in any of it. So if you've got some issues and something's going on at home, then, you know, someone else on the crew probably has the same problem. So,
well, talk about that a little bit. How do you support each other on the crew in that way, sort of emotional support? What kinds of stuff do you do to keep people bolstered during their, what is it, a 72-hour shift, and maybe much longer depending on the fire situation?
Yeah, the 72-hour shift is just like whatever, you know. That's just another shift. But when you're gone for months, that's when it's like, I don't know. It's you're in such a weird state because you're always so deliriously tired and focused on the task at hand. But we are there for each other. I mean, it's. If you need to talk about something, like, while there is this level of, you know, aggression that is generally like a motif throughout the crew, there's not that toxic, quote, toxic masculinity thing, at least on our crew, which is, you know, you can be vulnerable. You can say the issues that you have and people aren't going to, you know, tell you to man up. They'll tell you to man up about just about every other thing.
or but, woman up.
Yeah,
or
person
on,
up.
On crew, yeah.
Person up.
In the last couple of minutes we have here, Joe, I just wonder, maybe you could share with us, what have you taken away from this experience? What have you learned with your time as a firefighter in the wild land?
It's helped me be a leader. It's helped me organize my own life. In terms of like prioritize and execute when it comes to just everything in life, it's hardened me up a little. So, you know, I can take whatever type of criticism. When people freak out or people are all emotional, I'm able to, you know, not let that affect me because it's like, oh, you clearly got something else going on. And that doesn't have to do with me, even though you're yelling at me, you know? And my ability to work with people has improved dramatically. I mean, I always consider myself a people person, but my ability to communicate and to support and to push people to be the better versions of themselves has improved. And it's just a great experience. Mm-hmm. I love doing it.
And picked up some mad chainsaw skills.
Oh, yeah, I know how to use a chainsaw now. The first day, they were like, oh, so who has chainsaw experience? And I said, me. I totally do.
That was a lie, though.
That was a lie. I
can tell you that.
I never picked up a chainsaw before. And, yeah, now I'm really good at it. Yeah. Now I can drop big trees.
Okay, listen for everyone. Well, this has been a joy to be able to spend some time with you and actually talk informally about what life is like as a wildland firefighter. My guest today on KWMR is also my son, Joe Fizakerly. He's a member of CAL FIRE's hand crew out at Pacheco Pass, and he's been to just a whole bunch of pretty major fires, as well as the smaller ones that you see on the roadside. And he's out there with his brothers and sisters protecting California and Californians. So.